there's not a lot of fighting or we're in each other's kitchen about doing this. Like, I'm the finance guy. I own that space in a lot of different aspects. And so it's partnering with people that have a very different skill set than you.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Ryan Andrews is a real estate developer and investors and the CFO and managing partner at Hiatus Homes. He and partner Jesse Russell launched the Hiatus Capital Fund in 2020 to scale and grow Hiatus's ability to expand across the Mountain West. Ryan has launched and managed 7 funds and is a specialist in structuring funds and joint ventures for real estate development projects. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me here. Looking forward to it.
Absolutely. Same questions I ask everybody who comes on here. Can you briefly just tell us, where did you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
Sure. Yeah, happy to. So all my background is in finance. When I was in college, I wanted to be a real estate developer, did a senior project and everything, all that was gearing up to try and launch into that. And then graduated in 2007, right as the real estate world was falling apart.
Good timing.
Yeah, exactly. So I went into just kind of mainstream finance, worked in for PIMCO and big bond management group. So did kind of the general finance thing for several years. And then worked my way back into real estate kind of 2016, 2015 through as basically an early employee at CrowdStreet. That was kind of my first launch back into the real estate space. That company was actually founded here in Bend, Oregon. I knew the owner. I'd done a different tech startup at that point, and they were just starting to launch their first online offering that was coming out of the Jobs Act. And so got to be a part of that. I was, I think, probably fourth or fifth employee there, ran their first, you know, couple of deals as like an investor relations role. And that is what really kind of got me back from just like pure finance into real estate. From there, I jumped into managing a fund, actually the first fund I was a part of, which was a real estate debt fund. We lent money to home builders. And just a real small boutique fund based here in Bend, Oregon. We lent across the Pacific Northwest. So we grew that fund, the partner of mine that had started that, grew that from about 700,000, so just a couple of loans, to about 20 plus million over a few years. And that really introduced me to how development works, how construction finance works. And then I left that a couple of years ago to, quote, go out on my own, whatever that means for all of us, and started doing my own project, structuring my own JVs, and really sitting in that CFO seat for development projects and doing both apartments and single family construction and land development. And along the way, I've launched and managed a series of investment funds, partially as a means to capitalize these different development deals so I could essentially do bigger deals than I could do on my own. And so that's a big piece of what I do today. We've kind of morphed all that into a brand called Hiatus Homes, which I'll talk about in a minute a little bit more, I'm sure. But that's kind of the snapshot.
Man, that's amazing. There's 100 different ways we could take this conversation, and I want to go through all of them, but I don't think we'll be able to. So let's see if we can hit some highlights here. You managed your first fund where you guys lent to home builders. You started about $700,000, right? And you grew that to 20 million. What sparked that idea? How did you find the home builders? How did you, because getting it started is probably the hardest part. So what did that look like? How did you?
Yeah, great question. So my partner that actually founded the fund had ran a similar construction debt fund up in Seattle for several years. Yeah. So he knew the real estate side of the business. I came in after having worked a year or so as this early employee with CrowdStreet, and I had a really good grasp of the new rules of capitalizing funds under the Jobs Act and 506C offerings and, you know, basically how deals were being structured today as opposed to, you know, 10 years prior or something, or prior to the 2008 financial crisis. So when we teamed up, my hat was really as the capital markets guy. And I was like, okay, you know, I've been at CrowdStreet. I've seen a bunch of deals get funded. I've seen how this works. I think I have a way we can grow this with a bunch of individual accredited investors and grow this over time. So that was how we launched that. We restructured that fund in order to grow it and attract more outside equity. At the time, it was just a bunch of friends and family of the gentleman that had launched it. So we then took it out as a broader offering. A little while later, we actually got it on the CrowdStreet platform. So after being an employee for CrowdStreet, I was then a customer of theirs for another couple of years. That was really effective way to source investor capital. And then we just tried to grow the brand and grow that fund. And it was while I was there, again, I still wanted to be on the developer side. So I started coming up with ways to create joint venture opportunities that were outside of the fund, just debt, and were equity. And so we'd structure like a special LLC that was just for a project. We'd take it out to the fund investors and say, hey, who wants to invest in the equity on a deal like this over the side? And so that's how I started structuring my own deals, basically, and structuring these, you know, side deals, and made, I feel like, oh, I don't know, you know, just learned through trial and error the best way to do it and the ways not to do it. We hired a lot of good legal counsel to help guide us through that. But really, you learn it by doing it. And so, you know, we did a fair amount of deals to varying degrees of success and worked through those. And then after a year or so of doing that, I was feeling like, okay, that's what I want to do. I don't want to necessarily manage this debt fund anymore. I want to, you know, launch into doing my own projects. And so then I moved into doing that more full time.
Right, right. That's absolutely fascinating. So you right now are a joint venture in how many deals, and are you guys the sole equity investor in a lot of these projects?
Yeah, good question. There's a super nuanced answer. So I have 5 developments that I'm a sponsor on.
Okay.
And so I'm a sponsor, manager, and always sitting in that what I call the finance guy, but it's a CFO type role. And so 2 of those are projects up in Seattle, 2 apartment buildings in Seattle. One is going through through entitlements to be a 68 unit apartment building in Ballard. That's called the Nestoon building. Another is a 6 unit development in Capitol Hill that we just finished a major rehab of, and we're trying to get our certificate of occupancy to rent that, and then we'll sell it in the next year. So those are 2 Seattle-based projects that I've been involved with for a long time. Then I have 3 projects in Bend, Oregon, my backyard where I live, under the Hiatus Homes brand, which you kind of mentioned in the intro about me, and that's a big piece of what I do. So with Hiatus Homes, we build small homes. So what, you know, are probably familiar to listeners as tiny homes, although we kind of shy away from that because people tend to think trailers on wheels, like cutesy trailers on wheels. That's not what we build. But we do build really small footprint homes. So about 400 square foot footprint, 600 square foot with dual lofts. We have a 2-bedroom model that's about 900 square feet plus a 1-car garage that's kind of a flex space 3rd-bedroom office. And so these homes are really efficient. They're energy efficient. So net zero or net zero ready with solar and, you know, super high energy efficiency. They're really small. So we can build to what I call detached high density. So rather than building duplexes or apartments, we build high density, but in single family detached. We just build small homes on small footprints. And that's been a labor of love over the last 5 years as we've gotten the city of Bend and other cities in Oregon to change their building codes, basically to allow you to build small homes on small lots. You didn't used to be able to do this 4 or 5 years ago. So it's a very new emergent space that's really attractive to a lot of buyers because they want a smaller home, less overhead, less cleaning time, higher quality of life. They love the energy efficiency. And they just love our design. It's a hyper modern, awesome design. And so that's the whole Hiatus Homes brand. And we have 3 developments inside the Hiatus Homes brand, 2 single family subdivisions and 1 apartment building. And those are in various stages. And so to draw the circle all the way back to your question, which was how do we capitalize these deals? So in order to capitalize the Hiatus Homes deals and really scale that up, Jesse, my partner and I basically said last summer, okay, we're going to create a fund, an evergreen fund that's going to act like a mutual fund for development deals. So investors can come in, they get exposure across all our projects. They could be investors in the fund for 2 years or for 7 years, depending on how long they want to be a part of this business. And investors can come in and come out. And that was the goal. Because traditionally, how real estate development always has been capitalized is by individual JVs and special purpose vehicles. Right. You create an LLC, you go out, you find investors to go in it, maybe you put in some personal capital, you get some loans, you do your project. When it's done, you sell it, you give all the money back to those investors, and then you try and do it again one at a time.
Right.
The problem there was the market for land is getting so competitive that what we were finding is we did not have enough time to go out, find a piece of land and say, okay, I think we like this deal. Let's get it under contract and then start feasibility. Now let's go back and call all of our investors, you know, a phone on each side of our head. Who wants to be in this deal? Let's pitch the deal. And so instead we said, okay, rather than doing that, we have to be able to have some discretionary capital, some cash to go tie up land and move forward on deals that are good and that we like because the market's so competitive. So by creating the Hiatus Capital Fund, we raised initially about $1.25 million into it to take down a couple of pieces of land and then go and tie up some more pieces of land, start working on entitlements on those. So now when we're out in the market, we can go find deals, we can tie up land, we can pay for our entitlements, our architecture work, our site work even out of cash. So we've got a big competitive advantage when it comes to sourcing land. And then when it's time to actually go vertical for the construction, we bring in construction lenders to take us vertical. But at that point, you know, the deal is pretty baked. It's a year or so into the deal. And so that was really the origins a year ago of the Hiatus Capital Fund was this way to scale this business instead of doing deals one at a time and then calling all of our friends and their friends. And then if we can't raise the money, we lose the deal.
Right.
And so a super long answer to your question of how we're financing these things.
No, I love it. I mean, that gives some real context to what you guys are doing and kind of what your thought processes are. How do you pitch that to investors? Hey, put your money in this fund. We don't know exactly where it's going. When we get stuff, we buy it. Like, what's that conversation sound like when bringing an investor into a fund?
Good question. Yeah, good question. And I'm really opinionated about this because I've been raising capital my whole career, whether it was, you know, starting early in the capital markets at PIMCO, where I created pitch decks. That was my whole job, was to create pitch decks for mutual funds, all the way up to, you know, I raised venture capital for a couple of years, then raised private equity for real estate deals and all. So what I said is investors are not going to buy because we bring this financial product to them. Investors are going to want to invest in our fund because they fall in love with our homes. So we always lead with our homes. We also realize that to some degree, the buyers of our homes, our purchasers and residents are actually often the same people that are investors in our fund. So we always lead with the homes and we lead with the energy efficiency. We lead with the small spaces. We lead with the changes, the paradigm shifts in building code that's taking place here and across the West. And, you know, even going out to the East Coast, certainly like there's major changes because there's such a shortage of housing. So we always lead with that. And investors fall in love with our homes, our design, our energy efficiency. They're like, that's awesome. I believe in what you guys are doing. I believe there is demand from homeowners for this asset class and for the homes that you buy. And we say, you know, that's great. Do you want to participate in this business? If so, you can actually own a piece of the company. You can be an equity holder in the development company that's building these homes because, you know, there's a shortage on lumber. There's a shortage on stoves and ranges and countertops and everything right now. It's hard to source all that. And, you know, one of the inputs into development is capital. And so we go out to these investors and say, you love our homes and our philosophy. Here's the way you can participate in our deals. And so, although on the one hand, it's very discretionary in that we can go buy a piece of land that we like without having to go call a bunch of investors to support it, it's very limited in the sense of we have a very narrow business scope of what we do, the homes that we build and the types of properties we look for. So if investors buy into that, they know there's a pretty narrow business model we're going to be investing in. But within that, we're pretty free to go find land and deals that are a fit with that. And so we don't lead with like, hey, why don't you give me some money and I'll go find a real estate investment to put that in. It's here's this narrow scope. Now, if you want to be a part of it, here's our fund and here's how it's structured.
Right, right. I love that. That's great. That's great advice. Yeah, because that's certainly, I think, a question that a lot of people would have. You talked earlier about the kind of constraints around lot size. So if you're going out and you're buying a piece of land and you're getting it entitled, what is and you said these were 400 square foot roughly homes?
Yeah, 400 square foot footprint.
Okay. So what is a lot size, you know, where you're building? Of course, every city can have its own code, but what's a lot size you guys can put these on? Like, what's the smallest allowable lot size?
Yeah, good question. So it used to be they used to be pretty big. Like, and so every different zoning overlay inside every different city has a different density per acre you can build on.
Oh.
So let's take, for instance, a very typical zoning might be standard residential, where you could put 7 homes per acre, kind of a lower density development. You could do 7 homes per acre. Those are pretty big lots to put a little tiny home on. And so we got a couple of different codes adopted by the city of Bend. And when I say we got them, it was really, you know, my partner, Jesse, was part of a series of working groups that worked with the city over years to get what's called the cottage code passed. And then recently the state of Oregon just passed House Bill 2001, which was a code that says all cities above a certain size have to allow basically higher density, smaller footprint housing in their residential building code. So that was a huge piece of legislation for us. So again, a long nuanced answer to say, where you used to be able to say, all right, you could put 7 homes per acre on this lot. Now under some of the new codes, they will take our small homes and say, okay, that just counts as a 0.25 of a home. So we could do 7 times 4. So we could do 28 of these per acre.
Wow.
And so there's no technical limit on lot sizes. It's a limit of units per acre, but then we have to have streets and setbacks. And also that becomes the limit on the one hand, not the actual minimum lot sizes. And then on the other hand, the market becomes a limiter on lot sizes. Because in our opinion, the market's not going to buy super high density here. We need to spread our homes out a little bit, provide some parking, provide access through streets, if people are going to actually buy these things and pay the cost that it takes to build them. And so those are really the limiters. It's not minimum lot sizes anymore.
That's awesome. And when someone gets into a home like this, the affordability of homes is obviously something else that we're running into, not just a shortage, but the affordability of them. I can only imagine.
It is.
Yeah, that you guys, are you able to bring these at a lower cost per square foot on the build side to market, or what's that look like?
Yeah, good question. So the economics around what I call affordable by design are really interesting. So there's some people call affordable housing, capital A affordable housing, like it's, you know, government program, it's subsidized affordable housing. Sometimes you get like density bonuses or a break on property taxes or something if you provide what sometimes gets called capital A affordable housing, like formal subsidized set aside affordable housing.
Right.
We're trying to do what we call affordable by design market housing. So what this tends to be is actually it's a higher cost per square foot to build, and it's a higher cost per square foot to sell. But you're selling a lot less square feet, but it's a fully functional home. And so the actual dollar amount somebody's coming in at might be half or two thirds of the market for that area.
Right.
So for instance, like let's look at the west side of Bend, Oregon. The west side of Bend, Oregon, if you're going to get, you know, your options for a modern new construction is going to be a 2,400 square foot home for $1.4 million. That's what you're going to be buying. Whew, that's not affordable to a lot of people. And so instead, what we can offer is something that's half that price, but also at half that square footage. So we'll sell a 900 square foot home, but it'll be, you know, 780,000. And so, but they still get that west side of Bend. Now, how that translates into the even smaller homes is the even smaller homes we sold between 220 and about $320,000. And so it was by far, it was half the price of anything else on the market in Bend, Oregon. Now you're buying a 400 square foot home, you know, or a 600 square foot usable home. So it's half the size, but it's still at a price point people could afford that was very different. And so when you go for the economics of affordable by design, you have to stop looking at per square foot metrics, and you have to start looking at actual dollar price as compared to competing offerings. And so because we still have to pay for kitchen and siding and foundation and city fees and all for a small home, our cost per square foot's higher to build. It's a lot higher to sell, but our actual dollar price is lower and is something that's affordable. And by taking our small homes off of wheels and putting them on stick built foundations, buyers can qualify for traditional financing. It's just like a regular home. And so there's no issues or hurdles around, you know, financing issues. And so, you know, that's the way we're trying to take a market-based approach to affordable housing. The other piece is just by doing this detached high density, we're able to put more units in the same footprint of an acre or a half acre infill lot, which the city, you know, city of Bend and a lot of West Coast cities just need more units per lot per acre. Mm-hmm. And so we're able to provide that. The more units that you provide, supply and demand hopefully pulls down the price long term. So again, it's a totally market-based approach. It's not a regulatory-based approach for affordability.
Right. And I love that for all of a million and one reasons, but not the least of which you're going to come up with some creative solutions that big A affordability is just not going to, they're not going to do. I mean, the private sector is always going to innovate at a faster and more efficient rate than what your government mandates. So,
right. You know. It will. Because, yeah. The profit incentive causes people to have good ideas.
Yeah. Absolutely. And you're solving a need. You guys are doing some really cool stuff there. I love that. There's one other piece of this puzzle I want to talk about today is you moved out of the real estate debt fund space. Are you out of that entirely, or do you still have the debt fund? Because I know you're doing JV equity, you're doing hiatus homes, you're doing, you know, small homes, you're doing, but do you guys still have a debt fund that you're running or not?
Good question. So I do personally. So I have another, so the hiatus homes and all the development projects is about half of what I do. It's a big chunk of what I do. And then the other half of what I do is manage investment funds. And so I have three investment funds I'm currently managing and involved with. One of them being the hiatus fund we already talked about. Another is a fund that's a closed-end fund called the Recession Resistant Fund. A partner and I put that together and we invested in mobile home parks, self-storage, and apartments a couple years ago prior to COVID. And so that was an awesome, fun investment. It's probably outside of the scope of our call today. But then the other piece that's more in line with kind of what you asked is I manage or basically help as part of a team to manage a fund called the Phoenix Real Estate Debt Fund. And so this is a pretty unique fund, $200 million fund. It's institutional grade. And what it does is it basically acts as a capital partner for lenders, private lenders that are construction funds, like the fund I used to manage, for instance. So all over the US, there's these private lenders that lend money to developers and home builders, you know, me on the other half of my business. Well, all these private lenders need capital and they get capital from individual investors, but they also get some capital from institutional lenders. So this Phoenix Real Estate Debt Fund is a fund that provides capital to various groups of lenders. And so I'm like the US operations side of that fund. So all of the capital for that fund comes overseas. It's a lot of individual accrediteds and individual investors and life insurance money and pension money from overseas. It flows through a Cayman Islands fund, US corporation. And then that from there, it's invested into 9 different partners currently. And so in the other half of my business, you know, my mornings, I say like, you know, 6 to noon, we'll call it, I have my lender hat on. And so I'm managing that large debt fund where I'm basically on the capital markets side of putting capital into large scale development deals. These tend to be loans that are where the loan is, you know, $10 to $100 million for a major retail development or major apartment development or something all across the US. And so I'm analyzing those to place our capital into those deals. And then I have lunch and, you know, that kind of patter, you know, pitters out for the day. And then I put on my developer hat and, you know, spend my afternoons capitalizing my other deals, working through entitlements and design and all on my own projects. And so, you know, it's really interesting. Those two sides of the business give me a view into one another. And so because I'm so involved in the institutional debt markets in financing large scale development projects, it completely changes the way I think about development deals as a developer. And same thing over here as a developer, when I go over here and look at debt deals that we might invest in, almost like on the buy side of a private equity fund is really what we do. I'm able to think of it as a developer. And so, you know, I understand the entitlements and the permitting and the costs and all a lot better than a lot of lenders that are just finance guys. And so those are the two sides of my, you know, kind of my personal business and what I do. And it's really fun. It's a blast to be involved on both aspects.
Man, I'm sure. I don't know how you get it all done. And I guess that's the question we'll end with before wrapping it up with the final four. But what has been your key? Because this is a lot to manage. There's a lot of moving parts. It's a lot of moving people. It's obviously a lot of moving money. So what has been maybe one or two keys that have really helped you do this and really do it efficiently, do it well, and keep your sanity?
Yeah, good question. So good partners and only partners is almost like my rule number one. And so what I mean by that is, so I partner with other people that have a very different skill set than me. And so we have very defined spaces around what I do and what they do so we can execute on it. There's not a lot of fighting or we're in each other's kitchen about doing this. Like, I'm the finance guy. I own that space in a lot of different aspects. And so it's partnering with people that have a very different skill set than you. And that's been hard for me. I've been in a lot of partnerships in the last, call it 7 or 8 years since I left kind of big corporate finance and started doing venture capital and building partnerships and entrepreneurships. I've made a lot of mistakes in partnership and been betrayed, had bad partners, had partners that were too similar to me, like things didn't work out. And so I've made a lot of bad partnerships, but that's how I learned good partner, how to spot a good partner, I think. But then the other piece of that is I don't have to manage partners. I would have to manage employees. So I don't want employees. I just want partners. Because partners manage themselves. Partners are incentivized the same way I am. They have upside, they have downside. They've got skin in the game and everything. And then even I have like an accountant that works for me on my deals here in Bend, Oregon that I sponsor, the development deals. And then I have two analysts that work for me on the real estate fund. But none of these people are my employee. All these people are their own consultants where they're doing this work for other people as well. They're running their own business. Right. Their business is just providing accounting services or financial analyst services. And so they are motivated. They're fast to turn things around. I don't have to manage them. I don't have to come up with jobs for them to do to fill 40 or 50 hours a week. They're at on call when I need them to be. And then when they're not, I don't worry about them.
Right.
And then I'm also really careful how I structure my deals with them, just how I'm always careful about how I structure my deals and my own compensation inside the partnerships, in that like I want my consultants to have a profit incentive as well. And so certainly we pay hourly sometimes for lots of traditional things that are paid hourly, might be accounting or whatever. But then also for analyst work, a lot of times I'll pay a fixed fee for loan analysis reports so that they're paid for a work product. And so whether they spend a lot of time or a little time, they benefit from the efficiency. And so I don't want to manage people's hours. I don't want to manage their time. I'm too busy to manage people. I just basically like execute on my to-dos. And then I spend time on the phone building relationships. And that's it. Those are the two aspects of my job, but I don't manage people. And that's the only way I can be efficient.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. Yeah, there's nothing really to add to that. You've said it well. You've said it well. In a previous life, owned a business, and that's when I had 30 some odd employees, and that's when I went bald. So
I'll bet. I'm hanging on to mine. I decided to get rid of it, to have no employees while I still had a little hair.
That was a smart move, man. I lost mine at 23 because I didn't meet you yet, and you didn't tell me that 30 employees can make you go bald. So, man, that's awesome. Ryan, you've got so much going on, and what a wealth of information and really just knowledge that you've shared with us today on, you know, how you guys are doing this. This is rock and roll. I really, really enjoyed it. And you're certainly somebody we can look up to in the commercial real estate space as someone who's doing it really well. Final four questions are this. If I gave you just $20,000 to invest in real estate, you have no previous real estate investing experience, what do you do with it and why?
Good question. Well, the no previous real estate investing experience is the twist. Me as me, I would go tie up a piece of land for development. But again, that's my business. That's what I know. And so let me think. I mean, one is a lot of people get started doing fix and flips. And that's really a good, easy way in to the business. There's a lot of mistakes that you can make, but a lot of people get their way in and kind of like the bigger pockets path of getting into real estate. So 20 grand, unfortunately, doesn't go that far in real estate right now. You know, you can try to tie something up, but let me throw out one other idea.
All right.
Here's what I might do. I'd take my 20 grand and I would go use it to find a really good property that I probably can't even buy myself. but I would use my 20 grand as an earnest money deposit. I'd get it under contract and make sure it was an assignable contract. And then I would call through my network to people that can buy pieces of real estate and be like, who wants to buy this piece of real estate that I tied up? I'll assign it to you. And I want a $20,000 fee for assigning it to you. And I use my 20 grand to tie it up. When I sell it and this thing closes, I get my 20 grand earnest money back, plus I get a $20,000 assignment fee on it. I doubled my money in 60 days. And then I'd probably try and go do it again on two more properties with my 40 grand and again and again and again. And I'll tell you what, guys like me in the position that I'm in as a developer, I would happily pay somebody 20 grand to go and source an off-market deal for me that I don't have time to go find some landowner that lives in Portland, Oregon and has owned this thing for 20 years and wants to sell it. And so there is an awesome opportunity for people that will go source deals.
Right.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Use it to wholesale a deal. That's awesome. Question number two is, if you could help our listeners avoid one mistake in real estate, what would it be and how would you avoid it?
Bad partners. I would at this point only partner with people that I had worked with previously in some kind of contract relationship. And so it's when you're early in the business, you're so eager to get into an equity partnership, LP or LLC relationship with somebody. But boy, that's like a marriage and that can go poorly. And so, you know, instead, either have somebody else be the main equity and you work for them under contract or vice versa. Bring somebody else in under contract and you be the main equity. Once you've done that for a year or two, or give your time away as just an advisor. And after you've worked with somebody for a year or at least through a deal, then maybe consider getting into a formal partnership with them.
Right. That's great. When it comes to investing in the world, what's one thing you're doing right now to make the world a better place?
Boy, I think high density housing, we're going after it. There's so much demand for housing and energy efficient housing. I think that's our thing. I think that's what people want. I think the 3,500 square foot homes in the suburbs are going away and people are wanting high density around cool infill retail and energy efficient. And so that's the impact we're trying to make with Hiatus Homes.
Right. That's awesome. Ryan, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
They can check us out at Hiatus Homes. You know, the website to that business, hiatushomes.com. I'm Ryan at Hiatus Homes is my email. And from there, if there's interest in chatting about any of my other businesses, the Phoenix Real Estate Fund, the Recession Resistant Fund, et cetera, we can always go from there. So yeah, thank you.
Awesome. Thank you, Ryan. Have a good day.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor, and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen. If you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.